Whatever meat you have ready in the back, I said, and a bottle of Avnish fruit wine strawberry if you have it. He leaned up against the bar and raised an eyebrow at me. His scowl reshaped itself into a small patronizing smile.
No sense rushing about, son. The constable will be wanting to talk to you now that you're up.
I clenched my teeth against my first choice of words and took a deep breath.
Listen, I've had an exceptionally irritating couple of days. My head hurts in ways you don't have the full wit to understand, and I have a friend who might be in trouble.
I stared at him, icy in my calm.
I have no desire to have things turn unpleasant, so I am asking you kindly to get me what I asked for.
I brought out my purse.
Please.
He looked at me, anger slowly bubbling up onto his face.
You mouthy little swaggercock. If you don't show me a little respect, I'll sit you down and tie you to a chair until the constable comes.
I tossed an iron drab onto the bar, keeping another clenched tight in my fist. He scowled at it.
What's that?
I concentrated and felt a chill begin to bleed up my arm.
That is your tip,
I said, as a thin curl of smoke began to curl up from the drab,
for your quick and courteous service.
The varnish around the drab began to bubble and char in a black ring around the piece of iron. The man stared at it, mute and horrified.
Now fetch me what I asked for,
I said, looking him in the eye.
And a skin of water, too, or I will burn this place down around your ears and dance among the ashes and your charred sticky bones.
I came to the top of the greystone hill with my travel sack full. I was barefoot, out of breath, and my head was throbbing. Denner was nowhere to be seen. Making a quick search of the area, I found all my scattered possessions where I'd left them. Both blankets. The water skin was mostly empty, but other than that, everything was here. Denner might have just stepped away for a call of nature. I waited. I waited for longer than was entirely sensible. Then I called for her softly at first, then louder, though my head throbbed when I shouted. Finally, I just sat. All I could think about was Denner waking alone, aching, thirsty, and disoriented. What must she have thought? I ate a little then, trying to think of what I could do next. I considered opening the bottle of wine, but knew it was a bad idea, as I undoubtedly had a mild concussion. I fought off the irrational worry that Denner might have wandered into the woods in a delirium, and that I should go look for her. I considered lighting a fire, so she would see it and come back. But no, I knew she was simply gone. She woke, saw that I wasn't there, and left. She had said it herself when we left the inn in Trebon. I leave where I'm not wanted, the rest I can make up as I go. Did she think I had abandoned her? Regardless, I knew in my bones that she was long gone from here. I packed up my travel sack. Then, just in case I was wrong, I wrote a note explaining what had happened, and that I would wait for her in Trebon for a day. I used a piece of coal to write her name on one of the greystones, then drew an arrow down to where I left all the food I had brought, a bottle of water, and one of the blankets. Then I left. My mood was not a pleasant one. My thoughts were not gentle or kind. When I came back to Trebon, dusk was closing over the city. I made my way onto the rooftops with a little more care than usual. I wouldn't be able to trust my balance until my head had a few days to mend itself. Still, it was no great feat to make it to the roof of the inn where I collected my boots. From this vantage, in the dim light, the town looked grim. The front half of the church had completely collapsed, and nearly a third of the town had been scarred by fire. Some buildings were merely singed, but others were little more than ash and cinders. Despite my best efforts, the fire must have raged out of control after I was knocked unconscious. I looked to the north and saw the peak of the Greystone Hill. I hoped to see the flicker of a fire, but there was nothing, of course.
I made my way over to the flat roof of the town hall and climbed the ladder to the cistern. It was almost empty. A few feet of water rippled near the bottom, far below where my knife pinned a charred shingle to the wall. That explained the state the town was in. When the water level had dropped below my makeshift sigildry, the fire had flared up again. Still, it had slowed things down. If not for that, there might not be any town left at all. Back at the inn, a great many somber, sooty people were gathering to drink and gossip. My scowling friend was nowhere to be seen, but a cluster of folk were gathered around the bar, excitedly discussing something they saw there. The mayor and constable were there too. As soon as they spotted me, they rushed me into a private room to talk. I was tight-lipped and grim, and after the events of the last several days, not terribly intimidated by the authority of two paunchy old men. They could tell, and that made them nervous. I had a headache and didn't feel like explaining myself and was quite comfortable tolerating an uncomfortable silence. Because of this, they talked quite a bit, and in asking their own questions, they told me most of what I wanted to know. The town's injuries were blessedly minor. Because it had been the harvest festival, no one had been caught sleeping. There were a lot of bruises, singed hair, and folk that had breathed more smoke than was good for them, but aside from a few bad burns and the fellow whose arm had been crushed by a falling timber, I looked to have had the worst of it. They knew beyond all certainty that the Dracus was a demon, a huge black demon breathing fire and poison. If there had been any slim sliver of doubt as to that fact, it had been laid to rest when the beast had been struck down by Talu's own iron. It was also agreed upon that the demon beast had been responsible for the destruction of the Morthan farm, a reasonable conclusion, despite the fact that it was dead wrong. Trying to convince them of anything else would be a pointless waste of my time. I had been found unconscious atop the iron wheel that had killed the demon. The local sawbone doctor had patched me up as best he could, and unfamiliar with the remarkable thickness of my skull, expressed serious doubts as to whether or not I would ever wake. At first, the general opinion was that I was merely an unlucky bystander, or that I had somehow pried the wheel off the church. However, my miraculous recovery, combined with the fact that I had charred a hole into the bar downstairs, encouraged people to finally take notice of what a young boy and an old widow had been saying all day, that when the old oak had gone up like a torch, they had seen someone standing on the roof of the church. He was lit by the fire below. His arms were raised in front of him, almost as if he were praying. Eventually, the mayor and constable ran out of things to say to fill the silence, and merely sat there, looking anxiously back and forth from me to each other. It occurred to me they didn't see a penniless, ragged boy sitting across from them. They saw a mysterious, battered figure who had killed a demon. I saw no reason to dissuade them. In fact, it was high time I caught a piece of luck in this business. If they considered me some sort of hero or holy man, it gave me useful leverage. "What did you do with the demon's body?" I asked, and watched them relax. Until this point, I had barely spoken a dozen words, responding to most of their tentative questions with grim silence.
"Don't worry about that, sir," the constable said. "We knew what to do with it."
My stomach knotted, and I knew before they told me. They'd burned and buried it. The creature was a scientific marvel, and they had burned and buried it like trash. I knew naturalist scribes in the archives who would have cut off their hands to study such a rare creature. I had even hoped, deep in my heart, that bringing such an opportunity to their attention might win me my way back into the archives. And the scales, and bones, hundreds of pounds of denatured iron that alchemists would have fought over. The mayor nodded eagerly and sing-songed.
"Dig a pit that's 10 by 2, ash and elm and row and tool," he cleared his throat. though it had to be a bigger hole than that, of course, everyone took a turn to get it done as quickly as possible.
He held up his hand, proudly displaying a set of fresh blisters. I closed my eyes and fought down the urge to throw things around the room and curse them in 8 languages. That explained why the town was still in such a sorry state. Everyone had been busy burning and burying a creature worth a king's ransom. Still, there was nothing to be done about it. I doubted my new reputation would be enough to protect me if they caught me trying to dig it up.
"The girl that survived the Morthan wedding," I said. "Has anyone seen her today?"
The mayor looked at the constable questioningly.
"Not that I've heard. Do you think she was connected to the beast in some way?"
"What?" The question was so absurd I didn't understand it at first. "No, don't be ridiculous," I scowled at them. The last thing I needed was to somehow implicate Denner in all this. "She was helping me in my work," I said, careful to keep things ambiguous. The mayor glared at the constable, then looked back to me.
"Is your work finished here?"
he asked carefully, as if afraid of giving offence.
"I certainly don't mean to pry into your affairs, but..."
He licked his lips nervously.
"Why did this happen? Are we safe?"
"You're as safe as I can make you," I said ambiguously.
It sounded like a heroic thing to say. If all I was going to gain from this was a bit of reputation, I might as well make sure it was the right sort. Then I had an idea.
"To be certain of your safety, I need one thing."
I leaned forward in my chair, lacing my fingers together.
"I need to know what Morthan dug up on Barrow Hill."
I saw them look at each other, thinking, how does he know about that? I leaned back in the chair, fighting the urge to smile like a tomcat in a dovecot.
"If I know what Morthan found up there, I can take steps to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. I know it was a secret, but someone in town is bound to know more. Spread the word, and have anyone who knows anything come talk to me."
I came to my feet smoothly. It took a conscious effort not to wince at the various twinges and aches.
"But have them come quickly. I leave tomorrow evening. I have pressing business to the south."
Then I swept out the door, my cloak trailing rather dramatically behind me. I am a trooper to my bones, and when the scene is set, I know how to make an exit. I spent the next day eating good food and dozing in my soft bed. I took a bath, tended to my various wounds, and generally took a well-deserved rest. A few people stopped by to tell me what I already knew. Morthan had dug up barrow stones and found something buried there. What was it? Just something. No one knew more than that. I was sitting beside my bed, toying with the idea of writing a song about the Drakkers, when I heard a timid tapping at my door, so faint I almost missed it. "Come in." The door opened a crack, then wider. A young girl of 13 or so looked around nervously and scurried inside, closing the door softly behind her. She had curling, mousy brown hair and a pale face with 2 spots of colour high on each cheek. Her eyes were hollow and dark, as if she had been crying or missing sleep, or both.
"You wanted to know what Morthan dug up?"
She looked at me, then away.
"What's your name?"
I asked gently.
"Verenia Greyflock,"
she said dutifully, then dropped a hurried curtsy, looking at the floor.
"That's a lovely name,"
I said.
"Averian is a tiny red flower."
I smiled, trying to set her at ease.
"Have you ever seen one?"
She shook her head, eyes still on the floor.
"I'm guessing no one calls you Verenia, though. Are you a Nina?"
She looked up at that. A faint smile showed itself on her stricken face.
"That's what my gran calls me."
"Come sit, Nina." I nodded to the bed, as it was the only other place to sit in the room. She sat, her hands twisting nervously in her lap.
"I seen it," The thing they got out of the barrow?
She looked up at me, then down at her hands again.
Jimmy, Morthan's youngest boy, he showed me.
My heart beat faster. What was it?
It was a big fancy pot,
she said softly.
About this high.
She held her hand about 3 feet off the ground. It was shaking.
It had all sorts of writings and pictures on it. Really fancy. I haven't ever seen colours like that, and some of the paints were shiny like silver and gold.
Pictures of what? I asked, fighting to keep my voice calm.
People,
she said.
Mostly people. There was a woman holding a broken sword, and a man next to a dead tree, and another man with a dog biting his leg.
She trailed off. Was there one with white hair and black eyes? She looked at me wide-eyed, nodded.
Gave me the all-overs,
she shivered. The Chandrian. It was a vase showing the Chandrian and their signs. Can you remember anything else about the pictures? I asked. Take your time, think hard. She thought about it.
There was one with no face, just a hood with nothing inside. There was a mirror by his feet, and there was a bunch of moons over him. You know, full moon, half moon, sliver moon.
She looked down, thinking.
And there was a woman.
She blushed.
Some of her clothes off.
Can you remember anything else? I asked. She shook her head. What about the writing? Nina shook her head.
This was all foreign writing. It didn't say anything.
Do you think you could draw any of the writing you saw on it? She shook her head again.
I only saw it for half a moment, she said. Me and Jimmy knew we'd catch a beating if his dad caught us.
Her eyes welled up with sudden tears.
A demon's going to be coming for me too, 'cause I seen it.
I shook my head reassuringly, but she burst into tears anyway.
Been so scared since what happened out at Morthan.
She sobbed.
I keep having dreams. I know they're going to come get me.
I moved to sit next to her on the bed and put my arm around her, making comforting noises. Her sobbing slowly wound down. Nothing is going to come and get you. She looked up at me. She was no longer crying, but I could see the truth of things in her eyes. Underneath it all, she was still terrified. No amount of gentle words would be enough to reassure her. I stood and went over to my cloak. Let me give you something, I said, reaching into one of the pockets. I brought a piece of the sympathy lamp I was working on in the fishery. It was a disc of bright metal covered with intricate sigildry on one side. I brought it back to her. I got this charm when I was in Valoran, far away across the Stormwall Mountains. It is a most excellent charm against demons. I took her hand and pressed it into her palm. Nina looked down at it, then up at me.
Don't you need it?
I shook my head. I have other ways of keeping safe. She clutched it, tears spilling down her cheeks again.
Oh, thank you. I'll keep it with me all the time.
Her hands were white-knuckled around it. She would lose it. Not soon, but in a year or two or 10. It was human nature. And when that happened, she would be even worse off than before. There's no need for that, I said quickly. Here's how it works. I took her hand that clutched the piece of metal and wrapped it in my own. Close your eyes. Nina closed her eyes, and I slowly recited the first 10 lines of Ve Valora Satane. Not very appropriate, really, but it was all I could think of at the time. Tema is an impressive-sounding language, especially if you have a good dramatic baritone, which I did. I finished, and she opened her eyes. They were full of wonder, not tears. Now it's tuned to you, I said. No matter what, no matter where it is, it will protect you and keep you safe. You could even break it and melt it down, and the charm would still hold.
She threw her arms around me and kissed my cheek, then stood suddenly, blushing. No longer pale and stricken, her eyes were bright. I hadn't noticed before, but she was beautiful. She left soon after that, and I sat for a while on my bed thinking. Over the last month, I had pulled a woman from a blazing inferno. I had called fire and lightning down on assassins and escaped to safety. I had even killed something that could have been either a dragon or a demon, depending on your point of view. But there, in that room, was the first time I actually felt like any sort of hero. If you're looking for a reason for the man I would eventually become, if you are looking for a beginning, look there. Chapter 83. Return. That evening I gathered up my things and made my way down to the common room. The townsfolk eyed me and murmured excitedly among themselves. I overheard a few comments as I walked to the bar and realized that yesterday most of them had seen me wrapped in bandages, presumably with terrible wounds underneath. Today the bandages were gone, and all they saw was some minor bruises. Another miracle. I fought to keep from smiling. The sullen innkeeper told me that he couldn't possibly dream of charging me, seeing as how the entire town was in my debt and all that. I insisted. No, no, absolutely not, he wouldn't hear of it, if only there was something else he could do to show his gratitude. I put on a thoughtful expression. Now that he mentioned it, I said, if he happened to have another bottle of that lovely strawberry wine. I made my way to Evesdown Docks and got a seat on a barge heading downriver. Then, while I was waiting, I asked if any of the dock workers had seen a young woman come through here in the last couple of days, dark-haired, pretty. They had. She had been by yesterday afternoon and shipped downriver. I felt a certain amount of relief knowing that she was safe and relatively sound. But other than that, I didn't know what to think. Why hadn't she come to Trayvon? Did she think I had abandoned her? Did she remember anything we had talked about that night as we lay on the Greystone together? We docked in Imre a few hours after dawn, and I went straight away to Devi's. After some spirited bargaining, I gave her the lodestone and a single talent in order to wipe out my extremely short-term loan of 20 talents. I still owed my original debt, but after all I'd been through, a 4-talent debt no longer seemed terribly ominous, despite the fact that my purse was largely empty again. It took a while to put my life back together. I'd only been gone 4 days, but I needed to make apologies and give explanations to all manner of people. I'd missed an appointment with Count Threep, and 2 meetings with Manet, and a lunch with Fela. Anchors had gone without a musician for 2 nights. Even Auri reproached me gently for not coming to visit her. I'd missed classes with Kilvin, Elksadal, and Arwil. They all accepted my apologies with gracious disapproval. I knew that when next term's tuitions were set, I would end up paying for my sudden, largely unexplained absence. Most important were Will and Sim. They had heard rumors of a student attacked in an alley. Given Ambrose's smugger-than-usual expression of late, they expected I had been run out of town, or at worst, that I was weighted down with rocks at the bottom of the Omethi. They were the only ones that got a real explanation of what had happened, though I didn't tell them the entire truth about why I was interested in the Chandrian. I did tell them the whole story, and showed them the scale. They were appropriately amazed, though they did tell me, in plain terms, that next time I would leave a note for them, or there would be hell to pay. And I looked for Denna, hoping to make my most important explanation of all. But, as always, looking did no good. Chapter 84. A Sudden Storm. In the end, I found Denna, as I always do, through pure accident. I was walking hurriedly along, my mind full of other things, when I turned a corner and had to pull up short to keep from running headlong into her. We both stood there for a half second, startled and speechless. Despite the fact that I'd been searching out her face in every shadow and carriage window for days, the sight of her stunned me. I'd remembered the shape of her eyes, but not the weight of them. Their darkness, but not their depth. Her closeness pressed the breath out of my chest as if I'd suddenly been thrust deep underwater. I'd spent long hours thinking about how this meeting might go. I had played the scene 1,000 times in my mind. I feared she would be distant, aloof, that she would spurn me for leaving her alone in the woods, that she would be silent and sullenly hurt. I worried that she might cry or curse me or simply turn and leave. Denner gave me a delighted smile.
Growth.
She caught up my hand and pressed it between her own.
I've missed you. Where have you been?
I felt myself go weak with relief.
Oh, you know, here and there.
I made a nonchalant gesture. Around.
You left me dry in the dock the other day,
she said with a mock serious glare.
I waited, but the tide never came.
I was about to explain things to her when Denner gestured to a man standing beside her.
Forgive my rudeness, Quoth. This is Lentaran.
I hadn't even noticed him.
Lentaran, Quoth.
Lentaran was tall and lean, well-muscled, well-dressed and well-bred. He had a jawline a mason would have been proud of, and straight white teeth. He looked like Prince Gallant out of a storybook. He reeked of money. He smiled at me, his manner easy, friendly.
Nice to meet you, Quoth,
he said with a graceful half-bow. I returned the bow on pure reflex, smiling my most charming smile.
At your service, Lentaran.
I turned back to Denner. We should have lunch one of these days, I said blithely, arching one eyebrow ever so slightly, asking, is this Mr. Ash? I have some interesting stories for you.
Absolutely.
She shook her head slightly, telling me no.
You left before you could finish your last one. I was terribly disappointed that I missed the end. Distraught, in fact.
Oh, it's just the same thing you've heard before. 100 times before, I said. Prince Gallant kills the dragon but loses the treasure and the girl.
Ah, a tragedy.
Denner looked down.
Not the ending I'd hoped for, but no more than I expected, I suppose.
It would be something of a tragedy if it stopped there, I admitted, but it depends on how you look at it, really. I prefer to think of it as a story that's waiting for an appropriately uplifting sequel.
A carriage trundled by on the road and Lentaran stepped out of the way, incidentally brushing up against Denner as he moved. She took hold of his arm absent-mindedly.
I don't generally go in for serial stories, she said,
her expression momentarily serious and unreadable. Then she shrugged and gave me a hint of a wry smile.
But I've certainly changed my mind about these things before. Maybe you'll convince me otherwise.
I gestured to the loot case I carried slung over my shoulder. I still play at Anchors most nights if you'd like to stop in.
I will,
Denner sighed and looked up at Lentaran.
We're already late, aren't we?
He squinted up at the sun and nodded.
We are, but we can still catch them if we hurry.
She turned back to me.
I'm sorry, we have a riding appointment.
I would never dream of keeping you, I said, graciously stepping to one side out of their way. Lentaran and I nodded politely to each other.
I'll come find you before too long,
she said, turning to face me as they walked past.
Go on,
I nodded in the direction they'd been heading.
Don't let me keep you.
They turned to go. I watched them walk through the cobbled streets of Imre, together. Will and Sim were waiting for me by the time I arrived. They had already claimed a bench with a good view of the fountain in front of the Aeolian. Water flared up around statuary nymphs, being chased by a satyr. I laid my loot case down beside the bench and absent-mindedly flipped open the lid, thinking my lute might enjoy the feel of a little sun on its strings. If you aren't a musician, I don't expect you to understand. Will handed me an apple as I took a seat next to them. The wind brushed through the square, and I watched the spray from the fountain move like gauzy curtains in the wind. A few red maple leaves danced circles on the cobblestones. I watched them as they skipped and twirled, tracing strange, complicated patterns in the empty air.
"I'm guessing you finally found Dana?"
Willem asked after a while. I nodded without looking away from the leaves. I didn't really feel like explaining.
"I could tell because you're quiet,"
he said.
"Didn't go well?"
Sim asked gently. "Didn't turn out the way I'd hoped," I said. They nodded sagely, and there was another moment of silence.
"I was thinking about what you told us,"
Will said.
"What your Dana said. There is a hole in her story."
Sim and I looked at him, curious.
"She said she was looking for her patron,"
Willem pointed out.
"She was travelling with you to look for him, but later she said she knew he was safe because he..."
Will hesitated significantly.
"Met with her as she was heading back to the Burning Farm. It does not fit. Why would she hunt for him if she knew he was safe?"
I hadn't considered that. Before I could think of a response, Simon shook his head.
"She was just making an excuse to spend time with him,"
he said as if it were plain as day. Willem frowned a little. Sim looked back and forth between us, plainly surprised he had to explain himself.
"It's obvious she has a thing for you," he said, and began counting on his fingers. "She finds you at Anchor's. She comes to get you that night, at the Aeolian, where we're drinking. She makes up an excuse to wander around the middle of nowhere with you for a couple of days."
"Sim," I said, exasperated, "if she was interested, I'd be able to find her more than once in a month of searching."
"That's a logical fallacy," Sim pointed out eagerly. "False cause. All that proves is that you're lousy at finding her, or that she's hard to find, not that she's not interested."
"In fact," Willem pointed out, taking up Simon's side, "since she finds you more often, it seems likely that she must spend a fair amount of time looking for you. You're not easy to track down. That indicates interest."
I thought about the note she had left me, and for a moment I entertained the thought that Sim might be right. I felt a faint hope flicker in my chest, remembering that night we lay atop the Greystone. Then I remembered that Dena had been delirious out of her mind that night, and I remembered Dena on Lantaran's arm. I thought of tall, handsome, wealthy Lantaran and all the other countless men who had something worthwhile to offer her, something more than a good singing voice and manly bravado.
"You know I'm right,"
Simon pushed his hair out of his eyes, laughing boyishly.
"You can't argue your way out of this one. She's obviously stupid for you, and you're just plain stupid, so it's a great match."
I sighed. "Sim, I'm happy to have her as a friend. She's a delightful person, and I'm glad to spend time with her. That's all there is." I forced the proper amount of jovial unconcern into my voice, so Sim would take me at my word and drop the subject for the time being. Sim looked at me for a moment, then shrugged it off.
"If that's the case," he said, gesturing with his piece of chicken. "Fela talks about you all the time, thinks you're a hell of a guy, plus the whole saving her life thing. I'm pretty sure you have a chance there."
I shrugged, watching the patterns the wind made in the fountain spray.
"You know what we should..."
Sim stopped mid-thought, staring past me, his expression going suddenly blank. I turned to see what he was looking at, and saw my loot case. Empty. My loot was gone. I looked around wildly, ready to spring to my feet and dash off searching for it. But there was no need. A few feet away stood Ambrose and a few of his friends. He held my loot loosely in one hand.
"Oh, merciful Taylor,"
Simon muttered behind me. Then at a normal volume he said,
"Give it back, Ambrose."
"Quiet, Elliot,"
Ambrose snapped.
"This is none of your concern."
I got to my feet, keeping my eyes on him, on my loot. I'd come to think of Ambrose as taller than me, but when I stood, I saw that we were eye level with each other. Ambrose seemed a bit surprised as well. "Give it to me," I said, and stretched out my hand. I was surprised to see that it wasn't shaking. I was shaking inside, half fear, half fury. Two parts of me tried to speak at the same time. The first part cried,
please don't do anything to it. Not again. Don't break it. Please give it back. Don't hold it by the neck like that.
The other half of me was chanting, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, like spitting out mouthfuls of blood. I took a step forward.
Give it to me.
My voice sounded odd to my own ears, emotionless and flat, flat as my outstretched palm. I'd stopped shaking inside. He paused for a moment, caught unaware by something in my tone. I could sense his unease. I wasn't acting the way he had expected. Behind me, I could hear Willem and Simon hold their breath. Behind Ambrose, his friends paused, suddenly unsure. Ambrose smiled and cocked an eyebrow.
But I've written a song for you, and it needs to be accompanied.
He gripped the lute roughly and dragged his fingers across the strings with no thought for rhythm or tune. People stopped to watch as he sang.
There once was a rabble named Quoth, whose tongue was quick at quipping. The masters thought him clever and rewarded him with a whipping.
Quite a few passers-by had stopped to watch by this point, smiling and laughing at Ambrose's little show. Encouraged, Ambrose made a sweeping bow.
Everyone sing!
He shouted, raising his hands like an orchestra conductor, gesturing with my lute like a baton. I took another step forward.
Give it back, or I will kill you.
At that moment, I meant it in perfect earnest. Everything grew quiet again. Seeing he wasn't going to get the rise he had expected from me, Ambrose affected nonchalance.
Some people have no sense of humor, he said with a sigh. Catch!
He tossed it to me. But lutes are not meant to be tossed. It twisted awkwardly in the air, and when I grabbed, there was nothing in my hands. Whether he was clumsy or cruel makes not the slightest difference to me. My lute hit the cobblestones bowl first and made a splintering noise. The sound reminded me of the terrible noise my father's lute had made, crushed beneath my body in a soot-streaked alley in Tarbin. I bent to pick it up, and it made a noise like a wounded animal. Ambrose half turned to look back at me, and I saw flickers of amusement play across his face. I opened my mouth to howl, to cry, to curse him, but something other tore from my throat, a word I did not know and could not remember. Then all I could hear was the sound of the wind. It roared into the courtyard like a sudden storm. A nearby carriage slid sideways across the cobblestones, its horses rearing up in panic. Sheet music was torn from someone's hands to streak around us like strange lightning. I was pushed forward a step. Everyone was pushed by the wind, everyone but Ambrose, who pinwheeled to the ground as if struck by the hand of God. Then everything was still again. Papers fell, twisting like autumn leaves. People looked around, dazed, their hair tousled and clothes in disarray. Several people staggered as they braced against a storm that was no longer there. My throat hurt. My lute was broken. Ambrose staggered to his feet. He held his arm awkwardly at his side, and blood was running down from his scalp. The look of wild, confused fear he gave me was a brief, sweet pleasure. I considered shouting at him again, wondering what would happen. Would the wind come again? Would the ground swallow him up? I heard a horse whinnying in panic. People began to pour from the Aeolian and the other buildings around the courtyard. Musicians looked around wildly, and everyone was talking at once. What's that? Notes are all over. Help me before they get. Did it? Him over there, with the red. Demon, a demon of the wind, and... I looked around in mute confusion until Willem and Simon hurried me away.
We didn't know where to take him,
Simon said to Kilvin.
See you all to me again,
Kilvin said calmly.
But this time, only one talks.
He pointed at Willem.
Try to put the words all in a tidy row.
We were in Kilvin's office. The door was closed and the curtains drawn. Willem began to explain what had happened. As he gained speed, he switched to Ciaru. Kilvin kept nodding along, his face thoughtful. Simon listened intently, occasionally interjecting a word or two. I sat on a stool nearby. My mind was a whirl of confusion and half-formed questions. My throat was sore. My body was weary and full of sour adrenaline. In the middle of it all, deep in the center of my chest, a piece of me burned in anger like a forge coal fanned red and hot. All around me there was a great numbness, as if I were sealed in wax 10 inches thick. There was no Quoth, only the confusion, the anger, and the numbness wrapping him. I was like a sparrow in a storm, unable to find a safe branch to cling to, unable to control the tumbling motion of my flight. Willem was reaching the end of his explanation when Elodine entered the room without knocking or announcing himself. Willem fell silent. I spared the Master Namer half a glance, then looked back toward the shattered lute in my hand. As I turned it over in my hands, one of its sharp edges cut my finger. I blankly watched the blood well up and fall to the floor. Elodine came to stand directly in front of me, not bothering to speak to anyone else.
Quoth? He's not right, Master,
Simon said, his voice shrill with worry.
He's gone all dumb. He won't say a thing.
While I heard the words, knew they had meaning, even knew the meanings that belonged to them, I couldn't pull any sense from them.
I think he struck his head, Willem said. He looks at you, but nothing is there. His eyes are like a dog's eyes.
Quoth, Elodin repeated. When I didn't respond or look up from my lute, he reached forward and gently tipped my chin up until I met his eye.
Quoth.
I blinked. He looked at me. His dark eyes steadied me somewhat, slowed the storm inside me.
Irelef Sedi, he said. Say it.
What?
Simon said somewhere in the distant background.
Wind?
Irelef Sedi,
Elodin repeated patiently, his dark eyes intent upon my face.
Irelef Sedi,
I said numbly. Elodin closed his eyes briefly, peacefully, as if he were trying to catch a faint strain of music wafting gently on a breeze. Unable to see his eyes, I began to drift. I looked back down toward the broken lute in my hands, but before my gaze wandered too far, he caught my chin again, tilting my face up. His eyes caught mine. The numbness faded, but the storm still turned inside my head. Then Elodine's eyes changed. He stopped looking toward me and looked into me. That is the only way I can describe it. He looked deep into me, not into my eyes, but through my eyes. His gaze went into me and settled solidly in my chest, as if he had both his hands inside me, feeling the shape of my lungs, the movement of my heart, the heat of my anger, the pattern of the storm that thundered inside me. He leaned forward, and his lips brushed my ear. I felt his breath. He spoke, and the storm stilled. I found a place to land. There is a game all children try at some time or another. You fling out your arms and spin round and round, watching as the world blurs. First you are disoriented, but if you continue to spin long enough, the world resolves itself, and you are no longer dizzy as you spin with the world blurring around you. Then you stop, and the world lurches into regular shape. The dizziness strikes you like a thunderclap. Everything lurches, moves, the world tilts around you. That is what happened when Elodine stilled the storm in my head. Suddenly, violently dizzy, I cried out and raised my hands to keep myself from falling sideways, falling upward, falling inward. I felt arms catch me as my feet tangled in the stool, and I began to topple to the floor. It was terrifying, but it faded. By the time I recovered, Elodine was gone. Chapter 85 Hands Against Me. Simon and Willem took me to my room at Anchors, where I fell into bed and spent 18 hours behind the doors of sleep. When I woke the next day, I felt surprisingly good, considering I had slept in my clothes and my bladder felt stretched to the size of a sweet melon. Fortune smiled on me, giving me enough time for a meal and a bath before one of Jameson's errand boys tracked me down. I was needed in the master's hall. I was due to be on the horns in half an hour. Ambrose and I stood before the master's table. He had accused me of malfeasance. In retaliation, I had accused him of theft, destruction of property, and conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. After my previous experience on the horns, I had familiarized myself with the Rerum Codex, the university's official rules. I had read them twice, to be certain of how things were done around here. I knew them like the backs of my hands. Unfortunately, this meant I knew exactly how much trouble I was in. The charge of malfeasance was a serious one. If they found me guilty of intentionally harming Ambrose, I would be whipped and expelled from the university. There was little doubt that I had hurt Ambrose. He was bruised and limping. A garish red abrasion colored his forehead. He wore a sling as well, but I was fairly certain that was merely a piece of drama he had added on his own. The trouble was, I didn't have the slightest idea what had really happened. I hadn't had the opportunity to speak with anyone, not even to thank Elodine for helping me yesterday in Kilvin's shop. The masters allowed each of us to speak our piece. Ambrose was on his best behavior, which meant he was very polite when he spoke at all. After a while, I began to suspect that his sluggishness might be from a too liberal dose of painkiller. By the glaze in his eyes, my guess was laudanum.
"Let's deal with the grievances in order of their severity,"
the Chancellor said after we had related our sides of the story. Master Hemme made a gesture, and the Chancellor nodded for him to speak.
"We should pare the charges down before we vote," Hemme said. "Elia Quoth's complaints are redundant. You cannot charge a student with both theft and destruction of the same property. It is either one or the other."
"Why do you say that, Master?" I asked politely.
"Theft implies the possession of another's property," Hemme said in reasonable tones. "How can you possess something that you have destroyed? One charge or the other should be set aside."
The Chancellor looked at me.
"Elia Quoth, do you wish to set aside one of your complaints?"
"No, sir."
"Then I call for a vote to set aside the charge of theft," Hemme said.
The Chancellor glared at Hemme, chastising him silently for speaking out of turn, then turned back to me.
"Stubbornness in the face of reason is hardly laudable, Elia, and Master Hemme makes a convincing argument."
"Master Hemme makes a flawed argument," I said evenly. "Theft implies acquisition of another's property. It is ridiculous to imply you cannot destroy what you have stolen."
I saw a few of the masters nod at this, but Hemme persisted.
"Master Lauren, what is the punishment for theft?"
"A student may be given no more than 2 single lashes across the back,"
Lauren recited,
"and must return the property or the price of the property, plus a fine of 1 silver talent.
"And the punishment for destruction of property?"
"The student must pay for the replacement or repair of the property."
"You see," Hemme said, "there is the possibility that he would have to pay twice for the same loot. There is no justice in that. It would be punishing him twice for the same thing."
"No, Master Hemme," I interjected, "it would be punishing him for theft and for destruction of property." The Chancellor gave me the same look Hemme had earned before for speaking out of turn, but I bulled ahead. "If I had lent him my loot and he had broken it, that would be one matter. If he had stolen it and left it intact, that would be another. It is not one or the other, it is both." The Chancellor rapped his knuckles on the table to quiet us.
"I take it then that you will not set aside one of the charges."
"I will not."
Hemme raised a hand and was recognized.
"I call for a vote to strike the charge of theft."
"All in favor?"
the Chancellor said wearily. Heme raised his hand, as did Brander, Mandrag, and Lauren.
5.5-4. Grievance stands.
The Chancellor pressed on before anyone could slow things down.
Who finds Raylar Ambrose guilty of destruction of property?
Everyone raised their hands but Heme and Brandir. The Chancellor looked at me.
How much did you pay for your loot?
9 talents and 6, I lied, knowing it to be a reasonable price. Ambrose roused himself at this.
Come now, you've never held 10 talents in your life!
Annoyed, the Chancellor rapped his knuckles at the interruption. But Brandir raised a hand to speak.
Raylar Ambrose does raise an interesting point. How does a student who came to us destitute come by such money?
A few of the masters looked at me speculatively. I looked down as if embarrassed.
I won it playing corners, sirs.
There was an amused mutter. Elodine laughed out loud. The Chancellor rapped the table.
Raylar Ambrose to be fined 9 talents and 6. Does any master oppose this action?
Heme raised his hand and was voted down.
On the grievance of theft, number of lashes sought.
None,
I said, raising a few eyebrows.
Who finds Raylar Ambrose guilty of theft?
The Chancellor called out. Heme, Brandir, and Lauren kept their hands down.
Raylar Ambrose to be fined 10 talents and 6. Does any master oppose this action?
Heme kept his hand down this time, looking sullen. The Chancellor took a deep breath and let it out in a rush.
Master Archivist, what is the punishment for conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum?
Student may be fined, lashed, suspended from the Arcanum, or expelled from the university, depending on the severity of grievance,
Lauren said calmly.
Punishment sought?
Suspension from the Arcanum,
I said, as if it were the most sensible thing in the world. Ambrose's composure broke.
What?
He said incredulously, turning to face me. Heme chimed in.
Heme, this is growing ridiculous.
The Chancellor looked at me with a tinge of reproach.
I'm afraid I must agree with Master Heme, Elia Quoth. I hardly think that this is grounds for suspension.
I disagree,
I said, attempting to bring all my powers of persuasion to bear.
Think on what you've heard. For no other reason than his personal distaste for me, Ambrose chose to publicly mock me, then steal and destroy the only thing I owned of any value. Is this the sort of behavior that a member of the Arcanum should exhibit? Is this the attitude you wish to cultivate in the rest of the Raylar? Are petty meanness and spite characteristics you approve of in students who seek to become Arcanists? It has been 200 years since we have seen an Arcanist burned. If you succeed in giving guilders to petty children such as this,
I gestured to Ambrose,
that long-standing peace and safety will be over in a scant handful of years.
It swayed them. I could see it on their faces. Ambrose moved nervously beside me, his eyes darting from face to face. After a moment of silence, the Chancellor called for the vote.
Those in favor of suspension for Raylar Ambrose.
Arwill's hand went up, followed by Lauren's, Elodin's, Elksadal's. There was a tense moment. I looked from Kilvin to the Chancellor, hoping to see one of their hands join the others. The moment passed.
Grievance failed.
Ambrose let out a breath. I was only slightly disappointed. In fact, I was rather surprised I had managed to carry it as far as I had.
Now,
the Chancellor said, as if preparing himself for a great effort.
The grievance of malfeasance against Elia Quoth.
From 4 to 15 single lashes and mandatory expulsion from the university,
Lauren recited.
Lashes sought?
Ambrose turned to look at me. I could see the wheels in his mind turning, trying to calculate how heavy a price he could make me pay and still have the master's vote in his favor.
6.
I felt a leaden fear settle into the pit of my stomach. I didn't care one whit about the lashes. I would take 2 dozen if it would keep me from being expelled. If I were thrown from the university, my life was over. "Chancellor," I said. He gave me a tired, kindly look. His eyes said he understood, but that he had no choice but to see things through to their natural end. The gentle pity in his look frightened me. He knew what was going to happen.
"Yes, Elliot," quoth.
"Might I say a few things?"
"You have already given your defense," he said firmly.
"But I don't even know what I did," I burst out, panic overwhelming my composure.
6 lashes and expulsion,"
the Chancellor carried on in an official voice, ignoring my outburst.
"All those in favor?"
Heme raised his hand. Brandier and Arwill followed. My heart sank as I saw the Chancellor raise his hand. And Lauren, and Kilvin, and Elksadal. Last of all was Elodin, who smiled lazily and waggled the fingers of his upraised hand as if waving. 9 hands against me. I was to be expelled from the university. My life was over. Chapter 86. The Fire Itself.
6 lashes and expulsion,"
the Chancellor said heavily. Expulsion, I thought numbly as if I had never heard the word before. To expel, to cast violently away. I could feel Ambrose's satisfaction radiating outward. For a second I was afraid that I was going to be violently ill right there in front of everyone.
"Does any master oppose this action?"
the Chancellor asked ritualistically as I looked down at my feet. "I do," the stirring voice could only be Elodin's.
"All in favor of suspending expulsion?"
I looked up again in time to see Elodin's hand, Elksadal's, Kilvin, Lauren, the Chancellor, all hands save Heme's. I almost laughed out of shock and sheer disbelief. Elodin gave me his boyish smile again.
"Expulsion repealed,"
the Chancellor said firmly, and I felt Ambrose's satisfaction flicker and wane beside me.
"Are there any further issues?"
I caught an odd note in the Chancellor's voice. He was expecting something. It was Elodin who spoke.
"I move that Quoth be raised to the rank of Raelar."
"All in favor?"
All hands save Heme's were raised in a single motion.
"Quoth is raised to Raelar with Elodin as sponsor on the 5th of Fellow. Meeting adjourned."
He pushed himself up from the table and made his way to the door.
"What?"
Ambrose yelled, looking around as if he couldn't decide who he was asking. Finally, he scampered off after Heme, who was making a quick exit behind the Chancellor and the majority of the other masters. I noticed he wasn't limping nearly as much as he had before the trial began. Bewildered, I stood stupidly until Elodin came over and shook my unresponsive hand.
"Confused?" he asked. "Come walk with me. I'll explain."
The bright afternoon sunlight was a shock after the shadowy cool of hollows. Elodin awkwardly pulled his master's robes up over his head. Underneath he was wearing a simple white shirt and a pair of rather disreputable-looking pants held up by a piece of frayed rope. I saw for the first time that he was barefoot. The tops of his feet showed the same healthy tan as his arms and face.
"Do you know what Raelar means?"
he asked me conversationally. "It translates as speaker," I said.
"Do you know what it means?"
he stressed the word.
"Not really,"
I admitted. Elodin drew a deep breath.
"Once upon a time, there was the university. It was built in the dead ruins of an older university. It wasn't very big, perhaps 50 people in all. But it was the best university for miles and miles. So people came and learned and left. There was a small group of people who gathered there. People whose knowledge went beyond mathematics and grammar and rhetoric. They started a smaller group inside the university. They called it